So when we talk about day-to-day activities, the day-to-day activities are creating a project team directory, negotiating with team members to get the best possible, assigning the job descriptions to the team members, understanding training needs, what needs to be delivered in terms of capability enhancement, creating situations in which conflict is being resolved. If there is rewards, recognition, sending out letters of commendation, rewarding, recognizing the people, and creating a staffing plan which will lead to the highest job satisfaction that one can get out of team members. Now, moving on to a project director. As we move into the different roles, please note and be sensitive to project manager, project director, who in the hierarchy is even more senior. Functional is different from project. Sponsor is different. So while you may see a lot of overlap of responsibilities, there are key demarcations which you have to be sensitive to. While, yes, there are certain things where there is an overlap from time to time, where as a whole accountability and responsibility is being taken. So a project director is someone with genuine executive authority over the project, has full accountability and subject to oversight by executive body. So typically a project director will sit way above your project manager. He's probably on the board of directors or reporting directly to the board of directors. And even though he may not be involved on a day-to-day basis in the project versus a project manager, accountability and responsibility definitely would lie on his or her shoulders. Then you have a steering committee. Some places would have a steering committee, which is a group of people charged with regular oversight of the project board. So collectively, they should represent all the significant areas of participation in the project, and they should have authority to take decisions on behalf of those members who would typically be department heads, vice presidents or directors, along with external representatives. So do you see that as we move to project director and steering committee, we are moving at very senior levels versus junior or middle management, where eventual accountability and responsibility does rest. So versus a team leader, a project director or a steering committee is way high in the hierarchy, where eventually, across various lines and dotted lines and structures and arrows, a team head would eventually in the long course be reporting to a project director or a steering committee, even though it may most likely will not be a direct reporting structure. So moving on to a team leader, and typically the project will be divided into various subheads, and the team leader would be responsible for managing and coaching the sub team and also tracking the aspects of the team. So you have a project, and within the project you have various functions. Now for those various functions, you may have teams created: designing team, communications team, admin team, networking team, marketing team. So you would have team heads for these various segments and activities, and these team heads would then be responsible for reporting to the functional manager or the project manager, and also for coaching and mentoring and getting the best outcome out of their sub-team. So not all the 20 people in a team, but the 3 or 4 people that form part of their design team, or the 3 or 4 people who form part of their marketing team. Other roles associated with the project are organizational change manager or facilitator. We've been discussing change, we've been discussing risk. Now, a lot of the good, responsible organizations also have important people to in advance to be there and ready and prepared to take on these risks and assess this change and work on this change as and when it happens. So these would be specialists in identifying issues, requirements and solutions regarding organizational change, corporate or individual rational, political and emotional factors in bringing about the desired business change. So these are extremely specialized people that some organizations may have. Now, we've been constantly talking about communication between team members, communication with sponsors, communication with external stakeholders like customers, communication between team members and a project manager. But as a whole, sometimes a project may have someone dedicated as a communication specialist. Then this would be a person communicating messages within the organization and the range of communications media that project should exploit. So any press releases, any communication to the board of directors, senior management. So this person's responsibility would not be functional in terms of coding, designing, sales, business development, would be in terms of communications and public relations. And most large organizations have communication specialists dedicated for these activities. A business process re-engineering specialist is a specialist in processing, re-engineering, communicating messages within the organization, and there will be a range to get optimum performance. So this is another kind of person or entity who could be involved with a project over and above the various others day-to-day ones that we have discussed. Process owner. So a person within the organization with overall control, authority and accountability for a given business process. Now see, when they have said process owner, they have not specified whether it is a project manager, whether it is the sponsor, whether it is the steering committee, because in a different organization, there could be a different person being the key process owner. But eventually the organization head or sponsor in an indirect way, even if not in a direct way, would become the process owner. But there could also be an organization where the project manager is tagged or assigned as the eventual process owner, because he's the one who is getting his hands dirty with the day-to-day activities. A process specialist is an expert in a best practice solution for a given business process. So these would be experts in their functional area. Then you have a process manager. A manager within the organization with detailed understanding and best practice solutions for a given business process, who are all part of regular activities which are going to be carried out. Interesting solution architect, a specialist defining overall best practices solutions for a given business process and giving the big picture. So best practices don't apply to any specific organization only. Best practices are industry-wide. So you may have a solution architect who could be bringing in all his knowledge and information from across the industry for this best practices big picture, that yes, while we're running this project, we're running it on these parameters, we are compliant, we are meeting with the regulation. If we also involve these aspects, then we are moving towards the best practices big picture, which will put us in the best light. A technical architect would be a specialist defining technical components and solutions for a given business process. Again, a very specialized function that we are talking about here. I think all of us know what a developer is. A specialist in creating a solution component. So software companies are full of program developers, solutions developers. These are experts in their functional areas. These are not generalists. When we were talking about generalists, or we were talking about people becoming experts in their technical area, these are obviously technical people, not really generalists. And there will be different types of developers depending on what is being developed. Are you developing a software product? Are you developing a pharmaceutical formula? Are you developing a banking solution? So depending on what your product is, the developer would be a specialized technical developer in that specific segment. You would have network and telecommunication specialists. They would deal with internal and external networking issues such as architecture, hardware, capacity, bandwidth, various elements that form part of networking and telecommunications parameters in any organization. Very, very important to keep in mind the training team. At several points of time, we have talked about skill upgradation, not just upgradation, skill acquisition. You have a team in place, but there is a need to improve a certain skill. There is a need to add a certain skill. So if there is a dedicated training team already available, whether it is a technical training team or it is a generalist training team, training on communications, training on various other business aspects, or whether it's training on designing, negotiating, networking, any of these things, they are specialists in identifying needs. Because if a person needs communications training and you're giving him a technical design training, it's a waste of resources. So you have to identify the training needs, and then you have to use trainers to make sure that this training is effectively delivered, and then you are also evaluating and in some way measuring whether this training has given the desired result or not, or has that been a waste of time and resources. Because whenever you're training, you're taking away time from the regular activities, day-to-day activities that the team member is conducting. Then you have technical writers who are specialists in identifying and creating accurate, usable documentation for future reference. Every good process or project has to have a track record, has to have a documented recording of the ongoings, of the process outcome, of the end result, of the various processes, and these are referred back at various points of time by various stakeholders and team persons and team managers. So you have technical writers to make sure that these are being documented properly. And of course, finally, you have the end user who forms the valuable resources in the team, and their feedback is important for improving the quality of the project. So you have testing which is done. So the end user may not always be the eventual customer. It may be an internal stakeholder who gives you feedback before, from the testing, before you improve it and take the final outcome to the customer. So end user could be the customer, it could be an internal team person also who could be a stakeholder. We keep hearing quality control, we hear of things like ISI mark, we hear of ISO 9000, various quality standard certifications. So you have quality managers responsible for process and procedures that require level of quality assurance. So they are internally making sure that that quality assurance is being met, and then some organizations and products and processes may choose to go and get that external certification or stamp also. But most good organizations will have internal stakeholders in by way of quality managers who are ensuring that these specifications are being met. Auditing is very important. So a quality auditor is a person responsible for quality audit and checking and certifying that declared procedures are followed properly. So you have your internal certification. If tomorrow it is discovered that you have not met with the compliance guidelines, of course, sponsors, project manager, team members would be pulled up, but your quality auditor is the person certifying it. So his responsibility would be very, very large in terms of making sure, or in case it was not met, why was it not met and where is the issue here. Now, as I had mentioned, the documenting roles and responsibilities becomes very important. Not just for reference later on, but also during the course of the project, to make sure that roles are clearly defined, responsibilities are clearly defined, reporting structures are clearly defined, and you have a seamless structure with as much little confusion as far as the roles and activities are concerned, interpersonal issues being a separate thing for now. So there are various ways in which roles and responsibilities can be defined. These are some of the key structures. One is the hierarchical chart, one is the matrix chart, and one is the text-oriented chart. So moving to the hierarchical type chart, it can be used to show positions and relationships in a graphic top-down format. So you could have a work breakdown structure, which is breaking down in terms of small tasks. Or you could have an organizational breakdown structure based on various departments, etc. Or you could also have something which is the resource breakdown structure in terms of how the various resources being assigned and what are the various requirements which are there. So I'll show you a diagrammatical representation which should make it clearer in terms of this is the project manager, and you could have the resources breakdown. You could have the organizational breakdown in terms of reportings, or you could have the work breakdown in terms of the various charts. So this is could be a very simple way for someone to just open, look at a specific aspect and see where it falls in the whole chain of the project which is at hand. Moving on to the mixed base chart, these use a responsibility assignment matrix or a RAM. Or a responsibility, accountability, consult and inform chart, which is used to illustrate the relationship between team members and the work that needs to be done. So this is a different format, and these can be developed at various levels like higher level RAM or unit responsible RAM for each of the components of the work breakdown structure, which would be taken down to a very minute level. And lower level RAMs are used specifically for role designation, because higher level RAMs are going to be slightly at an overseeing position. Lower level RAMs are going to be the ones which are talking about roles and responsibilities at a specific work breakdown level of specific activities. So the matrix format is also called table and allows a person to see all the activities associated with one person or to see all people associated with one activity, because we have to keep in mind that there are sometimes multiple activities. So obviously now I'm going to show it to you as a diagrammatic representation, which again helps you understand better that you have the activity, design, development, test, you have a resource A, B, C, D, and you have given various assignments in terms of responsibility, who is accountable for it, who is providing the information, and who is providing the consultancy. Now look at it. Now if we look at resource B, resource B has a responsibility when it comes to defining. As far as testing is concerned, he is simply informing. And as far as development and design are concerned, he is accountable. Now resource D is only informing when it comes to defining. When it comes to designing and development, he has more of a consultant role. And as far as testing is concerned, he has the responsibility for it. So this is again a very transparent and lucid way to understand how the various activities are laid down. Then you have your text-oriented formats, which, as the name suggests, are more of writing down in text in a very descriptive way about the roles and responsibility. And they usually form an outline and lay down information about responsibilities, authorities, competencies, qualifications. And I'll again show you a graphic representation, role, responsibility, authority. Lays it down. Diagrammatically, if you see, this would probably pertain more to individual team members, whereas the previous two formats that you saw had a consolidated picture in terms of various resources coming into the same thing. Now here also you could have another way, another form of representation where you have the various resource types laid down and you have the duration in terms of over the weeks and over the months, and you have the various text put in about where the responsibilities and the activities stand. Now moving on from documenting roles and responsibilities, let's look at the leadership styles. I have repeatedly been saying individuals are different, projects are different, organizations are different. So accordingly, obviously there are different ways in which people choose to lead. In the past also, I had mentioned about certain structures like demographic structure, chief programmer structure, where different levels of autonomy, involvement, decision making were there. Now let's go to the different leadership styles as an extension of that. So you could have a project manager who is leading his team in a different kind of way. So you could have a project manager who is choosing to direct and tell others what needs to be done all the time, or you could have a manager who is being simply a facilitator in terms of involved at the periphery, or you could have someone who is playing more of a coaching and instructing and mentoring role but leaving the day-to-day activities. So moving specifically into different styles, look at the words here. There is autocracy, somewhere there is consult, somewhere there is consensus. So there are different ways. Autocratic would obviously have a lot more of decision, where you are fetching inputs from others as well. Consulting would also invite ideas from others, and consensus would also. So here is, this is not a very dictatorial style where one person is making all the decisions. So you have different levels of involvement of team members and the interplay between team members and your project manager, which could come into play for different leadership styles. And sometimes based on the need and the organization's culture, project manager would adopt a different style. Now, each style has its advantages and disadvantages, but a lot of times the decision on what kind of style you will use, whether that is a consulting, mentoring kind of style, whether that is a style where you are involved in a very minute way, you are micromanaging, whether that is a style where you are completely hands-off and you're letting the team members discuss among each other and arriving at the solution, could be decided by the size of the project as well. So some styles may work better for larger size projects and work maybe disadvantages for smaller style. Likewise, there would be certain styles where smaller which would work better in a smaller project than in a larger project. So a lot of times the size of the project and the size of the organization also becomes an influencing factor in which leadership style a person might actually adopt. So moving on to autocratic managers, these managers, they solicit little or no information from their team members. So they are taking their decisions on their own. There is not a lot of creativity and discussion happening among team members. It is more of a one-way communication from the project manager to the team members in terms of instructions, guidelines, report back to me, feedback, etc. Now, what this can do is it can lead to quick decision making. Also, in terms of conflict, if the decision maker is just one person in terms of the autocratic manager, then he decides and the team members don't really have a choice to like it or dislike it, agree with it, disagree with it. You have to go along with that decision. So it can lead to very quick decision making. However, there are disadvantages because it can be demoralizing because the team members don't feel involved at all. And if they just have a one-sided decision slapped on them, then they have to also keep in mind that if there is a conflict, and they disagree with this decision, or this decision led to conflict between them and another team member, then that conflict is left hanging and is left unresolved. So there is little growth, there is little creative thinking, and it can lead to demoralizing, and it can also lead to a lot of staff members quitting. So very often you hear about people quitting because they had a dictator boss. So an autocratic boss could be leading to high turnover. And may not be the best leadership style. Then you have your democratic managers. They take the final decision, but they include the team members in the decision-making process. There is a lot of creativity. There is a lot of discussion happening between team members. So a team member can feel like I contributed. I learned from my mistakes. There is high productivity. If I could contribute and my suggestions were actually taken, then maybe tomorrow I can move to a higher project management role as well. However, this is not always effective when you need to make a quick decision. Because if there are multiple people involved and you're waiting for everyone to come on the same page, you're waiting for all your team members to become part of this discussion, you are thrashing the various thoughts and then arriving at a decision, then obviously that involves, the more the heads, the more the speakers, that involves time. Then you have your laissez-faire style of discussion. This type of managers give their team members a lot of freedom. And they let them decide how to set deadlines, when to get back with it. And they provide the support if needed. Otherwise, they stay out. They stay out of the picture. They're more of figureheads rather than functional involved heads. They will get involved only as and when required if the help is solicited from them. Now, this can lead to very high job satisfaction because you are giving a lot of autonomy and also in a way authority and flexibility to your team members. So you are giving them a chance to learn and you are also giving them a chance to grow. However, this could also have a disadvantageous effect because sometimes there could be things going wrong and you're not getting involved. You're not getting involved at the right time. Decision making may be happening too late. It could be that managers don't have control over their work or their people. So sometimes you may choose to be a figurehead who is not getting involved in your team members' day-to-day activities and giving them a lot of authority. But it could also be that you don't actually command respect from them and don't have control and they just don't listen to you and overstep you. So laissez-faire has to be taken with a pinch of salt. Yes, one should treat employees and team members as adults, but there has to be some amount of accountability and involvement beyond being completely hands-off. Then bureaucratic managers, as the name suggests, are very, very in terms of the way we see in the government setups. These type of managers solicit information from a selective team member, but the project manager is still the sole decision maker and they follow rules rigorously and ensure that people follow procedures precisely. So I am not suggesting that any of the other styles break rules, but there could be creativity in terms of following the rule yet doing something in a more effective way. Bureaucratic managers are more rigid and not open to exploring different suggestions or ideas at all. And it is appropriate for work involving serious safety risks, because there you don't want to steer from the tried and tested absolute broad thick black line. So it there this could be a safety risk, could be a reason why someone is choosing to be a bureaucratic manager, managing the project in a bureaucratic way versus giving a lot of freedom and flexibility to the team. Power and authority of project managers is based on the type of organization structure, and the project manager needs to exercise different levels of power and authority when working with a team. So if I am a vice president who has been made a project manager and I have someone who is just below the vice president level, and I have someone who is an intern who is not even a management trainee, who is a fresher. So the person right below me has experience of maybe just 2-3 years less than me, and the person who has just started out has a couple of months of experience. Then obviously I have to see that the way I will manage the person at the next level of seniority is going to be a lot less controlling versus the way I'm managing the person who is a fresher, who needs a lot more hand-holding, who needs a lot more guidance. So there could be various aspects coming in determining how much power and authority I exert at which level. There could be a certain task. Here I spoke about experience level, but there could be a certain task which is fairly simple and seamless, in which case I don't need to exert too much power and authority, versus in a very complex task where there are chances of a lot of things going wrong, there are chances of a lot more guidance and coaching required, in which case I will exert more power and authority in that. So to put it largely, a project manager's power and authority involves formal, legitimate, positional aspects leading to reward. Of course, a project manager has to be the person who lauds someone if they do well. You have to send the positive message that we are rewarding outperformance, and that clearly outperformers are recognized above average performers or above underperformers, so that motivates them to work better. Likewise, penalty. If someone has broken rules or someone has underperformed, it could be simply that I ignored them, or if I want to clearly discourage, the aspect of underperformance or rules being broken, then I penalize them, either by way of warning or by way of any other form. So that sends a clear message that breaking of rules is not condoned. Underperformance is not condoned. I take them off key responsibilities. So the way rewards help to give morale boost to my outperformers, penalties also discourage behavior which is detrimental to the positive outcome of the team. I act as a referent, associative, charismatic person, and I am also an expert who is providing a lot of expert advice and coaching and mentoring and hand-holding which my team people require. Formal or legitimate or positional power is based on the person's formal official position in the organization structure in the company and has been designated as a project manager in writing, where he has been given the power to make decisions. So clearly, as the name suggests, I am a vice president, I am a director. Based on this directorial position or a vice president position, I have been made in charge of this project, and this has been formally documented and communicated to everyone, and now everyone is going to follow that. So that is very fairly clear. Rewards, as I said, is making clear monetarily or in terms of morale boosting intangibly or in terms of recognizing someone in an internal newsletter or at an award ceremony, that clearly outperformance is recognized and outperformance is going to be distinctly rewarded versus average or underperformance. So you are not at par with them. There is a sweetener, there is an incentive for you to give that extra edge and to perform to the best of your capabilities and give the maximum utilization. Likewise, penalty in terms of discipline, reprimand, reduction of responsibility, change of role, to give a clear message that underperformance or breaking of rules or anything which is undesirable is not going to be condoned. So again, you are being set aside with a clear message being sent to the entire team and to the organization. Referent power is the kind of power obtained from being associated with people in power. So I am a vice president, but I network with the CEO of the company and I go to networking events, networking with the CEOs of all the companies in the industry. So that is referent power, and it is often used when the person does not have real power but would like to influence an action. So I, as a team head or as a project manager, am connected to the CEO. My team is not listening to something and is not delivering on something where I would like their delivery, and I then fire from the CEO's shoulder. I either use the CEO's name and say this needs to be responded to and you need to revert on that, or I actually get the CEO to give out a message, clear and transparent message, that XYZ needs to be delivered on. So this is referent power, when I would like to have something influenced which I am unable to, and I use the power of someone a lot more senior to influence this action. Expert is the best form of personal power, which is obtained through special knowledge and experience. So if I am a team head of a program which involves a lot of coding, and I am a coding expert, a well-known industry coding expert, then that is a lot of personal knowledge and power which I have, which can go and endorse and help me to get command respect and also to mentor and coach my team. So to summarize, we have seen lots of things in this chapter in terms of various stakeholders, in terms of the roles and responsibilities, in terms of organization charts, team charts, various documentation. So a lot of things which come in as far as various aspects of human resource management are concerned: rewards, responsibilities, resource allocation. Human resource management is an extremely dynamic, exceedingly dynamic segment. So never ever take it as being exhaustive. These are some of the things which one would be mindful of in terms of keeping in mind, whether it is a leadership style, whether it is specialization, whether it is training needs, whether it is any of these things. So these are some of the things which we have confronted, and before we move into the next module, we can just think about everything that we have learned here. So thanks a lot.